Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations with the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 108 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Greg Dowd Talks Trade with a Trump Spin, about a presentation given by Ambassador Greg Dowd, Chief Agricultural Negotiator in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, during the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention on November 17, 2018. Dowd is a longtime friend of the wheat industry, having gotten his start as Assistant Director of U.S. Wheat Associates' Portland office. In fact, his old boss, John Oates, now retired, was in the audience for his presentation, and you'll hear Dowd reference his old friend several times. A Kansas farm boy and Trump appointee, Dowd believes in his boss's negotiating strategy, arguing that all the easy stuff has been accomplished long ago. For those who support the president's strategy, Dowd's sober, fact-filled explanation provides a reassuring framework. Several times during the first 15 minutes of his presentation, Dowd mentioned that he probably wouldn't be as open if there were press in the room. And there was. A reporter from Capitol Press sat at the table directly in front of him, busily typing away, saying nothing about his affiliation. Although I'm not a reporter, I understood that Dow's expectation that his words weren't being recorded cooked my goose as far as producing a podcast. I wasn't going to be the one to reveal U.S. trade negotiating tactics. Luckily, my conundrum solved itself. The third time Dowd brought up the absence of media, he directly addressed the reporter typing in front of him and asked if that was indeed who he was. Awkward. But to me, it was a podcast lifesaver. At least for that portion of Dowd's comments that came after the notification that he was on the record. True, I had to trash 15 minutes of some really good inside baseball talk about our trade partners and strategies for dealing with each one, but Dowd talked for another 20 minutes and then answered 10 minutes of questions. Besides, it's not as though he pulled his punches after he knew he was being quoted. Dowd opened his presentation by letting his audience of farmers know that he was one of them.
You know, I'm a Kansas farm boy, grew up on a farm in Kansas. My dad still farms. I own part of the farm. And it's the farm is about traditionally about half wheat and then half row crops, soybeans, grain sorghum, etc. And it's a pretty interesting conversation back home. Things have changed in north central Kansas. We almost didn't plant any wheat this year for the first time in history, just because of changes in economics, et cetera, on the farm there. But I got my master's in bachelor's in animal science, master's in ag econ from K-State, and was looking for a job and ended up working for this rascal right here. My first job was I was the first assistant director of the U.S. Wheat office in Portland, Oregon, and John Oates was my first boss. So it's great to be back and see John. I haven't seen you in close to 20 years, maybe. So that was 1991, 1992. So I was 12 then. No, So I went from U.S. Wheat to private commodity analyst to the chief economist for the cattlemen for many years to the Senate Ag Committee. Couldn't hold a job, kept going to the Commodity Markets Council, and got offered this job here a while back, and it took 49 weeks from the time I was offered the job till the time I actually was confirmed by the Senate and got in the job. And I think that speaks volumes as to how things are a little wrapped around the axle when you have to deal with the Senate these days. It's unfortunate that we have gone quite a while here in agriculture and in trade without getting much done. And the to-do list is long. I want to talk to you this morning about what we're doing in the administration on the trade agenda, what's going on, and where we hope to take this and hope to go. And I beg your forgiveness a little bit here. I've got a little bit of congestion, and they've been running me pretty hard here. I got here about midnight last night, flew directly here from Morocco. That was about a 25-hour trip, John, door to door. So, and then I have to mention the fact that, of course, you know, you get to the hotel, and who's right next door there, literally, is one of your hospitality suites. So, it was okay, though. Suffice it to say, you could have driven a freight train through there, and I wouldn't have heard it. I was pretty tired last night.
Dowd talked for a good 15 minutes at this point about the trade in the world, the countries the U.S. is negotiating with, and even some of the strategies for moving forward. I've eliminated all that from this recording. Interestingly, I don't think the tenor of his subject matter or his comments changed much after he recognized the reporter. Immediately afterward, he launched into another description of what's wrong with China's trade policies.
China. So the conversation in the end of May, 1st of June, we had our book was about 16 different things that we raised. And by China's tally, when we went down through the 3 days of conversation, they raised I think 46, 48 different issues. And I can assure you, that's just in agriculture, and I can assure you it's more than that. But what I can tell you, and this is important for everybody to know, is that these conversations with China are pretty serious in agriculture, and we start with two things. Did you realize that we actually have two of the biggest WTO cases in the world against China now in agriculture? And in fact, we're going to hear about the first one here sometime in the fairly early next year. The first WTO case involves China's subsidies to its farmers, wheat, corn, and rice. By that analysis, we believe China has exceeded what it was allowed to do in terms of expenditures on its farmers by $100 billion. So that's 100 with a B, billion. But we don't really know, because China hasn't reported to the WTO what it's spent on its subsidies since 2010. They're the only country in the world that has done that. It's truly outrageous. There's another case in terms of China's Tariff Rate Quota Administration on, again, corn, rice, and wheat. Now, China does buy some wheat, and it buys it from this part of the world now for the first time. That was TCK, John, was one of the first SPS issues I ever was taught by you. Craziness. But China, if they fully implemented what they agreed to do when they became a member of the WTO in 2001, they should be importing every year about 9.6 million metric tons of wheat. They've never done that. They've never done that with any of the commodities. And so we're saying, look, that's a violation of being a member of the WTO. You've got to get with the program here. So it's is this relative? What? Let me give you some context of all of this. And usually, I have really good staff, and they give me all the statistics here. But I don't know if how many of you saw the last USDA report and what we did with China and grain stocks. Did anybody see that? John, they took China's corn stocks from 58.5 million metric tons up to over 200 million metric tons. I got to stop and tell you a story. This is just for John. So it was 2000 or 2001. After I left U.S. Wheat, I gave the industry outlook presentation on wheat, and I'd done all this analysis and all these guys saying, well, lay it out for us. And my analysis at that time was, and this is relevant, I promise, was that China had to import 4 million metric tons of wheat back in those days. And they hadn't imported wheat from anybody in years. And I gave the presentation, and the chief economist for ConAgra stood up and he said, Greg, that's actually pretty interesting, because I agree with you. I follow your logic here very well and your numbers, and you make a very, very good point. And at that point, the head of the World Board at USDA in those days, Jerry Bangy, stood up and he said, Greg, you're absolutely right, based upon the numbers you have today. And everybody in the room went, well, he just told us something, but we have absolutely no idea what it was. Well, about 60 days later, USDA came out and doubled China's grain stocks across the board. Translation, they'd come to the same conclusion, and they called the Chinese and said, you're clearly lying about what your numbers are. Well, that was 2000, 2001. We've just gone through that exercise again. If you look at last month versus this month in terms of China's stock numbers, they went back 10 or 15 years, everything has changed again. The point is, 200 million tons of corn stocks, that's almost over 60% of all the corn in the world. China today has over half of the residual supply of wheat in the world. So when their support price for wheat in China is double the world price, China, you're killing the price of wheat for every other farmer in the world. Stop. Play by the rules. When I sat down and had this conversation with my counterpart at the end of May, 1st of June, I said, look, what you've done in terms of reforming your corn program is helpful. Your support price for corn 3 or 4 years ago was over $9 a bushel. No wonder you've produced all this corn. And what they even realized is we can't store it. It's going out of condition. This is insanity. We've got to stop. And I said, yes, we learned the same thing in the U.S. in the 1980s. 60% of our corn was owned by the government. It was a disaster. Don't do it. Don't go down this road. So they've made some changes. That's what we want China to do. But here's where the fundamental conversation was when I talked to him. I said, look, in corn, you may have to import 5 million tons of corn every 2 or 3 or 4 years. It's okay. We can do this. And that's where he bristled. And it was fascinating to me. He said, I'm not sure that we can rely on the world for that amount of product. We have to, the Communist Party of China, they like control, and particularly when it relates to commodities. And this is something that this is the issue of our time here that we have to cope with, is we have to help China understand that there's a whole great big world out there in agricultural commodities and folks that can supply this. You've got to play by the rules. Work within the confines of your TRQs and your domestic subsidies to do this. There's one other country that we're having the same conversation with in a little different way, and that's India. Now, India does it a little different. They send the WTO their numbers, but then in the case of wheat, the number that they provided was actually a negative number. And we went, okay, how does that work? So we looked at India's USDA and USDR spent some time and looked at India's own websites and did our own analysis. And my first trip to Geneva in this job, I slid a piece of paper across to the Indian ambassador to the WTO. And we said, we've looked at your own websites. And in the case of rice, we have found that your level of subsidy was actually 8 times what you were allowed to do. Maybe that's why they're the biggest rice exporter in the world, maybe? In the case of wheat, it's 6 or 7 times what you're allowed to do. We just did some numbers on cotton. Australia's doing some numbers on pulses. India? Uh-uh. Play by the rules. Do what you're supposed to do here. And so this is the conversation we're having with all of our trading partners in the world right now. For how many years, how many decades, the U.S. and the subsidies to U.S. farmers have been the blame for all the ills in agricultural markets. Our point is, we don't even have an ability to understand what we are doing today in the world of agricultural trade because China doesn't give us any numbers and India's numbers are dead wrong. And how many other places are the numbers right? We have to have a conversation. This is just a little Econ 101, commodity analysis 101. If you're going to get things right, you have to start with the right numbers and understand what's going on. In other words, it's going to be garbage in, garbage out if you sit down and try to negotiate this. And that's the conversation we're having with everybody right now. And we're beginning to come around to the notion that, the U.S. is right. Things have changed. We've got to play, we've got to get some better analysis and numbers and data to do all this. So that's what we're working on. And I want to close the comments here with talking about Europe. And this is going to be a long and difficult conversation. But even with the media in the room, I'm going to make this comment. The great challenge that we have in agriculture in front of us today going forward is the fact that there are too many activists in this world making money, scaring people about the food that they eat. That's just what it is. It's a business model. And, you know, when we have politicians in that part of the world get asked agricultural questions and their responses, and this has been the response in one case that I've seen, well, I'm not sure, I better ask Greenpeace first before I get back to you. That's what we're seeing here in our line of work. What Europe is doing in terms of pesticides is just unbelievable. What they've recently announced that they're doing in terms of antibiotics is truly remarkable. And the fact that they're going to cause real damage here in terms of animal agriculture. This is something that we have to watch and be very careful. But I want to close by a comment that I received day before yesterday when I was in Morocco from a professor there in the livestock industry in Morocco. And it was a fascinating conversation. We were talking about Europe and kind of talking about this conversation. You know, Morocco is Francophone Africa, so they speak French. And he said, the conversation was, he said, you know, in the schools here now, the hottest thing is English. And all the upper-level folks want to send their kids to American schools. And he said, I'll tell you why. Because the great challenge that I'm having in my profession is that there is no new or a valuable technical or scientific information published in French. If you want to get new technical stuff, the only place you can read it is in the English language. I saw a statistic the other day in terms of high-tech companies. Of the top 20 high-tech digital companies in the world, none of them are in Europe. And only 8 of the top 200 are in Europe. We have a great advantage in our country in terms of technology. And when you talk in terms of, obviously, Seattle, Portland, the Silicon Valley, everybody here understands that. Digressing a little bit, when we talk about China, you know, one of the great challenges we have is Made in China 2025. How many of you have seen that or read that document? You should do that. China has indicated that what they want to do with that document is build national champions and dominate industries. They want to do in to the Silicon Valley what they did in solar panels. They've spelled it out to the world. By the way, what is it, one of the other industries in Made in China 2025 that they put on the piece of paper that they want to build a national champion in and dominate? Anybody tell me? Agricultural machinery. Really? So, and this is a president that has said, look, we see China not playing by the rules across the board. We see Made in China 2025. We see the China Belt and Road Initiative. And we see that China is the second largest economy in the world. So it's time to just say, whoa, wait a minute. China, it's time. We need to sit down and have a conversation. You're the second biggest economy in the world. When it comes to intellectual property, cybersecurity theft, forced technology transfer, you've got to play by the rules. And that's where this situation is coming from with regard to the tariffs back and forth. So we did a report, USTR did a report early on in this administration. It took 8 months, 4,000 person hours. It's a 200-page document. There's a 14-page executive summary on our website where they talk about these issues. And that is the document that came that said this: we believe the United States has lost $50 billion as a result of China's actions. As a result of this, China said, well, we don't agree with you, so we see your $50 billion and we're going to match it. And the president said, China, you don't understand. I'm not trying to, you know, hurt you. I'm trying to get you to the table. You've got to sit down. We've got to sit down and figure out how to sort this out. So okay, 50 billion is fine. We import 500 billion from China. We export 150 billion from China. He said, let me help you understand how serious I am. Here's 200 billion now in tariffs. Do you understand that I'm serious? Do you understand that it's time that we sit down and have this conversation? And so this is where we're at this moment in time. And those of you that know me know that it gives me no pleasure to talk about the problems and the tariffs and what this has resulted in terms of issues in trade for U.S. agriculture. This isn't any fun at all. But what I want you to understand is I also know that, yeah, China buys $12.7 billion worth of soybeans from us, but they don't buy the wheat that they should buy from us because of the TRQ stuff. They don't buy any rice from us. They don't buy corn because of they like biotech, but only Chinese biotech. They don't like our biotech. After it took us 15 years to get a thimble full of beef in there, they don't buy any poultry because of high-path avian influenza. And we think it's a $1 billion market for pet food, but they won't even buy that from us. And so that's what most people, and I think most U.S. farmers understand, is, yeah, we sell them a lot of soybeans, but they hardly do anything else for us in terms of access for U.S. agricultural exports. This is where we need to sit down and have this conversation. It's time. And that's what we're going to try to do. And so we've got some offense going on with Japan and some other things. But this is the point in time we are in terms of U.S. agriculture. With that, John, I think I'm going to stop. We've probably lectured you long more than you wanted to hear. But I don't get out here very often and have a chance to talk to farmers one-on-one like this. And I want to open it up and give an opportunity for as many questions as you want to ask today while you have me here. And by the way, tomorrow or Monday, I'm headed to Seattle to they're teaching me seafood 101. So that's this old Kansas hog farmer and beef guy. Now I've got to learn seafood. So there's, you know, learning dairy, learning seafood. It never ends. There are all kinds of different things you have to deal with and learn in this job. So, questions?
One questioner asked Dowd to talk about the USMCA agreement, which will replace NAFTA when approved by Congress, specifically the ability to move U.S. wheat into Canada. The questioner also asked for a comment on U.S. withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, trade treaty.
I think on the origin rules of origin issue to be able to ship U.S. wheat into Canada, I think we did get all of that fixed. I think. We worked really, really hard on it. That was a huge priority. One of the issues, though, we didn't have any ability to deal with was we're still going to have the variety approved by the Canadians to be able to send it up there. We've got some approved. I'm not sure how all that gets sorted out. But I think in terms of everything but that, we made some progress there. With regard to TPP overall, I was in the room with the president when he said this, and I will tell you, I have a master's degree in this stuff. He's exactly right. He said, look, the problem with TPP is when you bring it down and you're negotiating with 11 countries all at the same time, you begin at the lowest common denominator across the board. And he said, but if you do it one at a time, you can get a better deal. Well, I can tell you mathematically, economically, he's exactly right. There's no arguing the point. And so what you need to understand with TPP is we already have deals with every one of these countries with the exception of Japan and Vietnam. Now Brunei, I'm not sure that matters. So if we get a deal with Japan, we get a deal with Vietnam, the U.S. has TPP. That it's the same thing. So we're talking actually to a couple of countries in Southeast Asia right now, and hopefully here soon you'll be able to see that we're actually going to begin to add hopefully more in terms of the offensive strategy here.
Another questioner asked whether the U.S. negotiating strategy of playing hardball in China was counterproductive, given that losing face is seen as particularly humiliating in Asia.
That's right. That is the issue. So you have to figure out a way to get them to come to the table in a way. The conversation is, look, this is in China's best interest to have things like intellectual property protection. you know, China's going to innovate and have products themselves that they're going to want to have protected in terms of intellectual property around the world, right? These are things, as they evolve, now as the second largest economy in the world, it's going to be in their best interest to do these things as well. That's the answer to your question. That's how you do this, is you have a conversation to say, look, we all need to play by the rules. It's in everybody's best interest to do this. It's not, we're not trying to, raise the stature of the U.S. and decrease the stature of China. We're just trying to help it so everybody benefits by the implementation and the development of technology as we grow and do things around the world. Otherwise, if you don't do that, what's the alternative? Who's going to spend the money to innovate for new pharmaceutical drugs or new antibiotics or new technology or things related to this? Who's going to do that if you can't protect your intellectual property? Well, that's basic to the world.
A questioner observed that it appeared the U.S. is going its own way with regard to many trade initiatives. Wouldn't it make more sense to join with other countries in the effort?
Great question. And the answer is yes. Okay? Particularly when it comes to things like these issues I've raised with the Europeans in pesticides and antibiotics and things like that. Many, many people in the world, many countries in the world have the same concerns that we do. And this is particularly the case with Undersecretary McKinney, the new Undersecretary for Trade position at USDA, and you heard from Jason Halfmeister. They are doing an unbelievable amount of work with the Codex, with the OIE, with these international standard-setting bodies to build coalitions to help people realize that, you know, in terms of, you know, John, remember we have the Japanese in the first floor of the Albers Mill building. They're doing all the chemical residue testing. Way back before, we had maximum residue level numbers in the Codex for the whole world to see. And this was the conversation I had with Morocco this past week with regard to BSE mad cow disease. I said, could you imagine if we didn't have an international document that said, when this, then this, when this, when then this. This is the standard for the whole world to use with regard to this disease. This is the standard to use with regard to all of these pesticides and the residues. We've come a long, long way in developing that. And we spend an enormous amount of time in terms of a global discussion to make sure that everybody understands that if you're doing it this way, then it's safe. What the challenge is that we have with the Europeans is they have this notion called the precautionary principle, where they say, well, if there's any doubt, then we don't do it. Well, that's just a heck of a way to run a railroad. You know, you can't make any progress if you're, you know, constantly going to be of that mindset. And where it really is culturally is, the challenge is, as Americans, we are germophobes. We don't like bacteria in our food. The Europeans are chemical phobes. They don't mind the bacteria. They don't like the chemicals. So culturally, that's really where kind of the clash is. And we have to, two different, completely different regulatory systems, we have to figure out how to bring these things together over time.
Having heard a lot of Trump bashing over the last couple of years, it was refreshing to hear Dowd's spin on Trump's trade policies. I don't think Republicans or Democrats disagree that something needs to be done with America's trade posture in the world, especially in China. The disagreement is over tactics and ensuring that longtime customers stay that way. That's all the time we have and then some. I hope you've enjoyed episode 108, or what I entitled, Greg Dowd Talks Trade with a Trump Spin. Please join me again next week for another episode of the Washington Grain Commission-sponsored podcast, Weed All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.